Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, continuing our countdown to D-Day's 75th anniversary with the memories of Americans who experienced that longest day firsthand three quarters of a century ago. One of those thousands of Americans coming ashore at Omaha Beach on June 6, 1944, was Idaho native Philip Houck, known as Pete to friends and his widow Beverly, who still has so many of the letters they exchanged during the war. Pete had a very unique assignment very early on that longest day.
At 3:45 in the morning, my crew went overboard on the ship, climbed down a rope netting into a 22-foot rubber raft. It was powered by a Lee J engine, which was electric, made absolutely no noise, and with an azimuth and a compass in my hand, we headed for the beach. Our job that night was to take out the big tank embutments that are pieces of steel that are crossed with 12-inch steel embedded in 15 feet of concrete, and they're a blockage so that trucks and tanks cannot reach the shore. And they were pretty sure that these would not be knocked out by the naval guns, and they weren't. So we went into the beach, and we put these bandoliers and C2 around the concrete portions, hoping to get it as far down as we could. I remember Earl, he said to me, he had a hold of my belt, and he said, "Pop, what the hell is this?" And of course, he had his hand on a trigger mine. And I said, "Well, if you don't let go of it easily, it could blow you up." I said, "It's a mine." And I won't say what he said.
I can imagine.
But we put our detonators in there and then put a time charge on them. So that they would go off. It was scheduled, I think, for, my memory's not so good, I think 5:45 or 6 o'clock was the time that was going to be the big firing. And then we headed back to our ship, and that was another scary time. If you can imagine, you're in a little boat, and these huge ships are covering that sea, and they're about 40 to 60 feet above you, and you're trying to find the ship you're supposed to go back to, and there are literally thousands of them. Well, fortunately, our number was 575, and I spotted that number, and we got there just as they started hitting the beach with the big guns off of the ships. And the noise was unbelievable. You couldn't hear. Actually, you couldn't hear anything. You couldn't, not a thing. And after a few minutes, you couldn't see a thing. And if you could, you couldn't through the tears that were just automatically coming from the sulfur and the smell, you know, bad. But anyway, then I went back in. My first trip on the truck, of course, was at 10 o'clock in the morning. The vehicles that we used in those days were fairly simple, but they had to be waterproofed. It'd be difficult for you folks to understand this, but they had to be waterproofed right up to about your belt line. And I was on my vehicle, that means about 5 foot. But we had to put a tubing over the carburetor, the breather intake. We had to set the gas pedal, the throttle, and everything had to be preset. And when you started your vehicle to go offshore or onshore, everything had to be set. But prior to that, they dug a trench a quarter of a mile long with 5 foot of water in it, and before we loaded our vehicles on the LCTs, they had to pass the test of running through this 5 foot of water without stalling. The first two trucks ahead of me, of course, stalled. So they took them out, and that put me number one in line. So when I was fortunate enough to go through and get right up to the front of the ship, so when they dropped that nose of that LCT, that's where I was, first truck off.
And what, describe for our listeners, if you can, what this truck was like, what the purpose of it was, and why it was so important to be over there on that beach.
Okay, I had what they called a coffin box right behind my seat. It was made out of 3/4-inch steel, and it was full of C2. That's a highly explosive. We had been training with dynamite, but C2 came out and was invented about that time, so we switched over to C2. On my right, standing in the seat, was Lieutenant White, and he was manning a 30-caliber machine gun. So when we came off that ramp onto the end of the water, we were the first ones, and I guess maybe by surprise, we dropped into the water, and the water was up around my belly button. It had passed my belt. And the captain said, "For God's sake, are we going to hit the ground?" And about that time, all 8 wheels driving, we hit the ground.
Those had to be some nervous moments there. You could be sinking into the drink and holding up everyone else behind you.
That's right. But we made that, and in my shirt pocket and studied for weeks was the direction in which I was supposed to go. And, of course, I had a compass mounted on my rig, and there was a little ravine to my right, which we headed for. And unfortunately, the sea was red with blood. The foam was red. You couldn't hardly breathe. So much sulfur in the air from explosions. The noise was baffling. And I was driving over pieces of human being.
I can see you and hear you. I know our listeners can hear you. They hear the emotion in your voice, and I can almost feel what that does to you, to take yourself back to that moment. And here you are. You're a 23-year-old kid witnessing all this.
It wasn't what I expected. But anyway, we got up into the ravine where they could not fire ammunition our way. And I said, "Well, how far up this ravine you want to go, Lieutenant?" And he said, "Why don't you stop it right here, and we'll wait for the crew to come up." Well, he stepped out of the unit, and I was sitting there shaking. And the warmth that was running down my legs was not from the ocean. I was scared to death.
Who could blame you? And anyone who's seen or read anything about that day and that location knows that there were many men who did not live to talk about it, and you had witnessed so many of them. And it sounds like at that moment you felt like you were probably going to be next.
You really, at that time, didn't know. There were probably several thousand bodies on the beach, and many that never made the beach. And when the lieutenant came back, he said, "I would like you to round up your crew." My crew was 14 men, and we were in demolition. And he said, "There are 2 bunkers that are still alive." It means that they were still firing on the troops down on the beach. And he said, "See what you guys can do about blowing it up." The Germans called them Weiterstandnesters. They're made of 12-foot-thick concrete with 1-inch reinforced rod running through them. They have a small donkey train inside linking them together where they haul their ammunition and stuff. And they only had a slit in the front part of these Weiterstandnesters that was about 6 inches, maybe 8, wide, and ran the full length of a 25-foot bunker. And in that, they would have machine guns on what they call arbitrating fire. It would fire back and forth and interlink and back and forth. There were really no men shooting per se through sights at the men on the beach. But there were so many thousand rounds going down and so many thousand men, the automatic machine guns couldn't miss anybody.
Absolutely. It's just a wall of gunfire, basically.
Yeah, right. That they were up against.
Right.
So pretty soon Earl came up. That's Earl Couch, my best friend. And he said, what's on the docket, Pop? And I said, well, leave your rifle, your canteens, anything extra you got, and put 25 pounds of explosives on your back, and pots and Meyer, and the 14 of us started crawling to the back of, I think it's bunker number 3, or Weiderstand Nester number 3. And he said, Jesus Christ, who's going to be our backup? Meaning, who's going to protect us? Well, the 1340th Engineers were primarily our backup, and they came behind us just with their own rifles. And so we worked our way up to the back door of number 3, and we put all of this powder or putty, whatever you want to call it. Some comes in brick, and some you can roll up in your hand and put around a tree and cut a tree down. But we blew the back door out, and then the 1340th came up and killed everybody that came out the door. And then we did that to one other one, and I keep forgetting whether it was Weiderstand Nester 2 or 3. And as soon as we finished that one, we had a little whistle that if an officer needed someone or if there was a new project or something coming up that we recognized. And I don't know who it was that gave us the high sign, but we then went to where the trucks were trying to come up off of the sand, and they wanted us to build a road and out of steel netting. Then we went into that road, and it was dark when we quit. I can't even remember, like maybe 8 o'clock at night or 7. And, of course, there was no chow that night and nothing to sleep in, so we slept in the sand. And that was the first day.
The first and, as it's been called, the longest. But he had many more. Wounded 6 months later in the Battle of the Bulge, he made it home to marry his sweetheart, Beverly. That was the voice of Pete Houck, who passed away in 2016. You can access his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, a D-Day vet who is not only still with us, he'll be in Normandy for the 75th anniversary, and not just as a spectator or honored guest. He has a very special job to do, one for which he is well-equipped. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.